It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
From the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., backed by the trusted voices of Team Fox. Team Fox. A clear, fresh voice cutting through the noise to tell the truth. It's the Guy Benson Show with Guy Benson.
It's Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. I'm Guy Benson. From New York City today and tomorrow, welcome to the Guy Benson Show. I'm so happy to have you along for the next 3 hours. 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and then around the clock for free on our podcast at GuyBensonShow.com or FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm political editor at TownHall.com. I'm a Fox News contributor, and in that capacity, join me tonight on Gutfeld at 10 p.m. That's Eastern Time, Fox News Channel. That should be a lot of fun as usual. It's Tom Shalhoub in for Greg tonight, I believe. Very fun panel. See you there. Also be doing a number of other TV-related duties here while I'm in New York the next couple days. We'll tell you about that as the programming notes come our way. We've got a lot to get to on the show today, including later this hour in studio, Charlie Hurt, our friend, will join us. Looking forward to that conversation. We've got some very fun clips to play for him. President Biden really on a roll. We'll explain what we mean by that, get Charlie's reaction. Dagan McDowell will also be here in studio. That's in our next hour. She, of course, is the co-host of The Bottom Line on Fox Business Network. Also in our middle hour, Dave McCormick. He is the Republican now officially in Pennsylvania as the nominee for the GOP in a very important Senate race. It's a winnable race. It's a tough one, but winnable. And last night in the Pennsylvania primary, he made it official because he was effectively running unopposed, but he is now the nominee. We will talk to him about what the general election campaign looks like, how he can actually win this long battle against a long-term incumbent with a very prominent family last name in the Keystone State. And then in our final hour, I'm looking forward to welcoming right here to the studio a current student at Columbia University, just up the road here in Manhattan. And he's Israeli on top of it. You can imagine how these last days and weeks have been for him. His story is incredibly compelling. He will share it with us. Again, that is in our final hour here today. And I'll just note in the meantime that the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is actually visiting Columbia University today to make remarks, of course, very much in favor of Israel, against anti-Semitism and the mob. I think it's great that a high-ranking government official is going to Columbia to plant that flag, the flag of the United States of America. And yes, to support Israel, the Jews on that campus, and people who are being menaced and bullied day in and day out by this pro-Hamas pack had taken over the school. And we've seen these protests sort of metastasizing across the country. There have been live images today in Texas, out in Southern California. Other students are seeing the example at Columbia and saying, hey, why not us? And I think the pushback needs to be swift, certainly swifter than it's been at Columbia. And I think it needs to make a point unapologetically and to send the Speaker of the House, and I'm glad that it happens to be a Republican speaker who has the guts and the conviction to go do that today. So that is part of the scene at Columbia. We'll get the inside look and inside explanation from that student that I mentioned coming up in just about 2 hours from right now. I want to start, though, by talking about politics, sort of like hardcore electoral analysis from yesterday in Pennsylvania. I talked about and teased how Dave McCormick, the Senate nominee, is going to be here with us later on in the show. I want to discuss what happened last night in the primaries in Pennsylvania statewide. And I think that there are a few potential red flags for Republicans in the numbers. I will also bring you, probably coming up in the next segment, some much more positive numbers and news for the Republicans in the Trump campaign. So a little bit of both. And before I go any further, I just want to make the caveat and state this. I think over-analyzing, over-extrapolating, over-interpreting any data from like a primary election or a special election or another lower turnout event, I think that can be a fool's errand. Right? You can, I think, draw wrong lessons sometimes from unrepresentative samples. That's something to guard against in my line of work. But there are trends that should be watched, and paying some attention to what voters are actually doing matters. So what we saw yesterday in Pennsylvania, no huge surprise in that Joe Biden easily won the Democratic nomination fight there, 93% of the Democratic vote. Donald Trump easily won the Republican side as well. They're the only two guys left in the race. Right? It's like there aren't really other options. If people are going to turn out and vote for someone else, that's to make a point. That's to lodge a protest. And yes, they had, it looks like, many, many thousands of Democrats went out of their way to come and vote either for this Dean Phillips character or to write in, you know, uncommitted. There's a big write-in campaign. It wasn't on the ballot. You had to physically come, show up, and write in uncommitted. That's sort of the Gaza-Hamas wing of the party urging their supporters to do that, and many thousands of them did. So, yeah, red flag there flapping in the breeze for the Biden campaign and for the Democrats. But on the other side of the aisle for the Republicans, Donald Trump won a lower share of the Republican primary vote last night than Biden won within his party's primary. Biden won 93% of the vote, and I know that's not counting all of the write-ins, but Trump won like 83% of the Republican vote. Overwhelming majority, obviously it's going to be him, but more than 155,000 Republicans turned out yesterday in Pennsylvania or mailed in their ballots to vote for Nikki Haley. Her name was still on the ballot, even though she dropped out, what, in early March, a month and a half ago. And I know in some of the other states, people say, oh, well, it's an open primary, so you've got Biden supporters and Democrats coming in to mess with Trump and make him look bad and register, you know, their dissatisfaction that way, even though they're not Republicans, and you've got left-leaning independents doing the same. When you've got a closed primary like you have in Pennsylvania, it's just Republicans. So you can't write them off that way. And whether you like it or not, and I'm sure Team Trump doesn't love it, or might be annoyed by it, but 155,000 plus Republican voters showing up to vote in a contest that is over for all intents and purposes for Nikki Haley as sort of the remaining avatar in the ballot against Trump, that is something that Republicans in the Trump campaign are going to have to deal with. When she left the race, when she dropped out in March back in South Carolina, her home state, she said, quote, it is now up to Donald Trump to earn the votes of those in our party and beyond who did not support him. And I hope he does that. He said, or she said, rather, at its best, politics is about bringing people into your cause, not turning them away. And our conservative cause badly needs more people. So she stopped short of endorsing Trump still for now. She said, it's on him. The impetus is on him to bring folks like these 155,000 people who just voted against him in Pennsylvania into the fold in a state that will be decided likely very narrowly. 155,000, that's a lot of people who would go out of their way. It takes effort to vote in a primary election in a race that's basically over. You're wanting to make a point there. Now, are some of those people going to vote third party or even vote for Joe Biden? Probably some of them have made that decision. But I think there's quite a few of them who will probably hold their nose and vote for Trump. Some of them aren't sure. They are undecided about what they're going to do. I think in that sense, Trump's running mate is going to matter. I'm not saying it needs to be or should be Nikki Haley. He can pick whoever he wants. But I think it's a strategic and important decision because there are voters who might be totally over Joe Biden and inclined to give him the boot, but they're just not comfortable for various reasons with Trump. and they want to see who his running mate will be. Trump has said that he doesn't think running mates really matter. It doesn't really affect elections. That might often be broadly true. I think this cycle is different because both of the leading presumptive nominees of the two parties are, 77, 78 and older. Age is a factor. Also, this is a rematch from 2020. Everyone knows all of the players involved, with one exception, whoever the new VP nominee is going to be for the Republicans. That is a chance to make another sort of new, hopefully good, first impression. Kamala Harris waiting in the wings for the Democrats. I think a lot of people want no part of her in the Oval Office. Who will Trump and the Republicans offer? I think that could be a piece of bringing at least some of the recalcitrant center-right people into the fold in November when so much is on the line in a state like Pennsylvania. And by the way, to have 155,000 people, Republicans, voting the way they did yesterday, you go through the closed primary states, one out of five Florida Republicans voted for someone other than Trump. One out of four did in Kansas. Almost one out of four did in Connecticut. There is this group of people, and I think just sort of insulting them and writing them off as a bunch of irrelevant dinosaur rhinos, it seems like a bad idea. Republicans need those votes. Trump's going to be the nominee. Does that get you across the finish line to win? That's a separate question. I'll also point out, in Pennsylvania last night, more Democrats turned out than Republicans. Like, just down ballot in the attorney general race, more than a million Democrats voted in the attorney general race in their primary, and the number for the Republicans was in the 800,000s. It wasn't really even that close. So what we're seeing, once again, is an emphasis on what I've been talking about, almost like a fixation now for weeks. The highest turnout, high propensity, most motivated, most reliable voters, Democrats have an advantage among that group. Where Republicans, and Trump specifically, has a huge advantage based on the polling, like 20 plus points, is among the sometimes reliable, occasional voters or rare voters, and in many cases right now, unregistered voters who would want to vote for Trump if they were registered. A lot of that is borne out in what we saw last night. Democrats, again, their people are the ones who are like circling the date on their calendar, and they're going to show up no matter what. Republicans have to figure out a way. I mean, it's essential to register those who aren't registered yet, among whom Trump has a huge lead, and then get those people who only sometimes vote to get ballots in their hands or show up at a polling place on an allotted day, whether it's early, whatever the rules might be. You got to take advantage of those rules. So I know that's a lot to throw at you. I'm not saying that what happened last night in Pennsylvania is some sort of huge warning signal flashing bright at the Republican Party. I just think if you look at overall turnout, where the Democrats had a significant advantage, and you look at unity, where despite all of his problems that are getting a lot of attention, Joe Biden did better than Trump on the unity front. And a lot of those 155,000 Nikki Haley voters, and a woman who's been out of the race for weeks, by the way, a lot of those voters are disproportionately concentrated in suburban areas, collar counties in Philadelphia, the types of places where Republicans have underperformed and therefore lost ever since 2016. We've seen underperformances in 2018, 2020, 2022 in exactly those kinds of counties where Nikki last night, no longer even an active candidate, hugely overperformed. That is something that Republicans and the Trump campaign, whether they're thrilled about it or not, is irrelevant. It's a reality. It's a political reality, and they need to be aware of it, cognizant of it, and adjust accordingly and make a play for those people while also doing all the other turnout-related things that I mentioned that are going to be vital if Trump is going to win. So those are some of the, I would say, I don't know, like 4 out of 10 level concerns that I have based on the data from last night in one of the most important states in the country on the electoral front. When we come back, I want to read to you some other numbers, brand new polling out of multiple swing states that will be very, very much anxiety-inducing for the Democrats and the Biden campaign. We reveal those latest numbers as soon as we come back. It's the Guy Benson Show in New York on a Wednesday. Don't go anywhere.
Same issues, but with a fresh perspective.
The Guy Benson Show.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Guy Benson. Thanks for tuning in. So I gave just a couple bullet points of potential warnings for the Trump campaign and the Republicans out of Pennsylvania last night. All right, how about this on the other side of the ledger? Brand new swing state polling from Bloomberg. And it is overall not great for Team Blue. Let's go state by state. In the head-to-heads, in North Carolina, Trump is up 10 points, 51 to 41 over Joe Biden. In Nevada, Trump is up 8, 51 to 43 over Joe Biden. In Arizona, Trump is up 7. This is a state, and actually, so is Nevada. Those are two states that Trump lost to Joe Biden narrowly 4 years ago, but now he's up. So in Arizona, Trump's up 7, 49 to 42% over Biden. How about Georgia, another state that flipped into the blue column in 2020? Trump is up 6 in Georgia in this poll, 49 to 43%. Wisconsin, arguably the swingiest of swing states. There was a poll, the sort of gold standard poll, Marquette out of there the other day that had Trump up 2 points. This Bloomberg poll has Trump up 4 points in Wisconsin, 48 to 44. Pennsylvania, which I just spent a lot of time talking about in the last segment. We have Dave McCormick, the Senate nominee, joining us later. Trump is up 1 point in Pennsylvania, 47 to 46. Finally, Michigan, the one sliver of good news for Biden, and he's up 2, the current president, the incumbent, up 47 to 45%. In the state of Michigan. These are all numbers from Bloomberg, just out today. And by the way, when you add in the broader field like RFK Jr. and others, in some of these states, Trump's advantage grows. In North Carolina, it's the same, 10 points. In Nevada, it's up 14 points when you include other people. Trump's margin gets bigger from 8 to 14. In Arizona, basically unchanged, 6 points versus 7. In Georgia, Trump's lead grows to 8 points in the wider field. In Wisconsin, basically the same, plus 3 as opposed to 4. Pennsylvania, exactly the same, plus 1 in both scenarios. And in Michigan, Biden's lead expands just a little bit by a point, which is actually exactly what our Fox News polling recently showed as well. So in terms of the public sentiment, I keep saying it, if the election were held tomorrow and public sentiment were reflected in the actual makeup of voter turnout, I think Trump is the favorite to win. The Democrats are really good at getting their people's ballots in. Republicans have work to do, but these are not numbers that are making the Biden camp very happy. Charlie Hurt joins us here in studio when we come back.
Always fresh, always fair. The Guy Benson Show.
Back here in New York in the worldwide headquarters of Fox News, it's the Guy Benson Show. Thanks for listening. GuyBensonShow.com, that's our website. The podcast is always free when the show is over. With us now is Charlie Hurt, opinion editor at the Washington Times and a Fox News contributor, and he will be guest co-hosting Fox and Friends tomorrow on the news channel. That's 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, FNC. I'll be doing the same thing on Friday.
See, great to see you. They have me come in to set the bar really low for you so that when you come in,
it's you have to clear the Charlie Hurt bar.
Right. Yeah, and it's like you don't even have to like lift your foot up to clear that bar.
Are you a morning person?
No, I'm not a morning person.
Me neither. It is. That alarm clock is rough on that show.
Yeah, and then like last night, I was like, I'm going to go to bed. I went to bed at like 8:30. And then some garbage truck decided to like clear out the alleyway outside my hotel room at 1:30. And so I've been up since 1:30. So I got a good solid 3 hours, really good 3 hours.
You couldn't get back to sleep?
No, because then I just started like, you know, you start reading the news. And these days the news is so amazing. You don't just like dip in and then dip out. You get into it and you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, you're ensconced.
Yeah. It's like, all right, I mean, it's a good time to be alive if you're in the news business.
That's true. I'm amazed that you even went to bed as early as you did, because I'm such a night owl. The earliest I can get to sleep is maybe 10, and you get 5 hours of sleep, something like that. But it's for a great cause, which is Fox and Friends. That's we'll see you there tomorrow morning. I'll be there on Friday. All right, Charlie. So I want to play a few things for you. Some sound bites of our president, Joseph R. Biden, who's been on a real spree of certain comments and flubs and mistakes. And we'll start actually with the latest installment of a little segment that we've begun recently.
And now time for Grandpa's Stories.
Get ready, pal.
So most recently we were talking about poor Uncle Bosie, who was eaten by cannibals, according to President Biden, and that didn't happen. It was a lie. We also had this one in Florida yesterday when he was down there for his abortion rally. There was this claim from Joe Biden in cut two.
I tell you what. And by the way, is that right?
The only reason I have a pension is because of you.
Well, we did get that done. Anyway. Besides, I used to drive an 18-wheeler.
This is another one of the grandpa stories that he's told. It's been looked into.
Yeah.
It isn't true, Charlie. And this now, this montage could go forever, but just an example. Here's a cut four of just some of the lowlights.
Anyway, besides, I used to drive an 18-wheeler. My uncle Bosie Ambrose J. Finnegan, he flew those single-engine planes as reconnaissance over war zones. And he got shot down in New Guinea. And they never found the body because there were a lot of cannibals for real in that part of New Guinea.
I, like an awful lot of people in this audience, was the first in my family to go to college.
I had traveled 1,200,000 miles on Air Force planes. You know how many miles you traveled on Amtrak? And I said, no, he said, 1,000,000. Ground Zero in New York. And I remember standing there the next day and looking at the building. I felt like I was looking through the gates of hell. It looked so devastating.
So we could go on and on. Those are just some examples, Charlie. He just makes things up constantly about his life.
Well, first of all, I have to defend the guy on the truck driver thing.
Okay.
I mean, that if you're going to fantasize about something you did in life, that's a pretty awesome one.
Yeah, that's fine. But I did the thing. Do you, when you were a kid, when you're in the car and you pass an 18-wheeler tractor trailer and you do the horn honk gesture, I did that. I would not then turn that into I was the driver.
Yeah, but I'm just saying the bar is set low here. But if you're going to fantasize about something, fantasizing about driving a big rig is that's pretty awesome. But I mean, it's incredible.
He didn't do it.
Of course he didn't. But that's the whole point. That's the fun of being in a fantasy, living in a fantasy. But the problem is, it's a reminder that, you know, this guy got bounced out of, what, 3 presidential runs mm-hmm. in his lifetime? Because of this.
Plagiarism.
Making stuff up.
Yeah.
And, like, and it is a gift for a politician to be so committed to lying that you can be corrected. It doesn't matter how many times you've been corrected.
Right.
You just keep lying.
Yeah.
Just keep going. And eventually you too can be leader of the free world.
Here's another one. The bridge collapsed in Baltimore, and then he made it about himself and cut 40.
I've been over that bridge a lot. I commuted every day for 36 years as a U.S. senator when my wife and daughter were killed. And I commute back and forth to be with my boys. And I'm over that area in Baltimore Harbor.
And he said he did it on the train, which he didn't because there aren't train tracks on the bridge. He talked about his wife and daughter being killed. That is true, horribly. But he also lied about that, accusing the other person of being a drunk driver, which
was the victim in the accident of being a drunk driver.
Yeah.
And that guy went to his deathbed having those accusations.
Yep.
And his family, it still grieves about it. You know, this is the most disgusting part about Joe Biden. And Joe Biden gets this sort of credit for being like this crazy old grandpa that doesn't know where he is.
Avuncular.
Yeah. But he's actually a really nasty human. And the idea that you're going to sit here and take a horrible accident like the bridge collapse or people's deaths or the loss of military personnel overseas and then make it all about you. It's disgusting. It's mm-hmm. gross. That's not only is that not a healthy person, that's a really bad person. And it amazes me that, and people in the press know better than this. I mean, he was never taken seriously on Capitol Hill. I used to cover him on the Judiciary Committee and Foreign Relations Committee in the Senate. He was a ridiculous person, and nobody took him seriously up there because he would make stuff up all the time. But he's also like the idea that the press like presents him as this nice guy who just like gets things wrong. No, he's not. Somebody who takes tragedies and insists upon making it all about himself. That's a gross person.
It is. And on the Uncle Bozy ordeal and the cannibalism, I actually missed this. I hadn't seen the clip until yesterday where our colleague Peter Ducey asked about it at the press conference like the next day. And he was asking, why would Biden say that false thing about his uncle being eaten by fellow humans in not Borneo, but New Guinea? And Peter just said, that's for Uncle Bozy. That's a tough way to go. Something like that. And Karine Jean-Pierre actually scolded him for making it's not funny. Don't make a joke about it. The president takes this very seriously. No, he doesn't. If he took his uncle's death seriously, he wouldn't lie about it.
Right.
And
exactly.
Bring in the cannibals. Who did anything to the cannibals?
Or for that matter, I mean, I hate to say this because it's really ugly, but you know, he does this with his own son's death as well.
Yep.
Where, and it's like, I'm sorry, could you imagine like wrangling your son's death around to make political points and then getting the details wrong repeatedly?
Like the country?
Yeah.
Where he died, the circumstances
exactly.
of the death. And then he couldn't remember it in the special counsel testimony. And then they said that was a lie.
And then claim special counsel brought it up.
Right.
When they didn't bring it up.
He brought it up, as he always does.
Yeah. And again, that's not the sign of, I mean, he is a troubled, addled, lost guy, but he's not a sweet old man. It's really gross. And I feel like he does a good job of acting like a doddering sweet old man, but anybody who's paying attention, if the press should not should be able to see through that, and I know that they know it,
they do, but they're just rooting for him. They want him to win, so that it just kind of gets swept.
He always wound up getting quoted in stories because, like, you're on Deadline on Capitol Hill, you've got a story and it's about something that some committee he's on, and you just need that quote, right? And so you're like
Biden will talk.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, Mikey likes it. You can get Biden to say anything. So you'd catch him in the hallway, and sure enough, he'll stop, he'll talk, and he'll give you whatever quote you need to wrap up your story. And then inevitably he winds up being like one of the first top two quotes, but this is back when people actually read newspapers. Nobody, mm-hmm. which of course, I don't, does anybody even know what a newspaper is anymore?
Vaguely familiar. So I want to play, Charlie, a few more sound bites for you. This one was a couple weeks ago. We had a little bit of fun with it. Technically, I agree with him, but he didn't mean it this way. Cut 39.
Are you ready to choose freedom over democracy? For democracy?
Are you ready to choose freedom over democracy? Actually, yes, we're a republic for a reason. Freedom is what matters more than democracy itself, but that's not what he meant to say.
Yeah.
As the Democracy Party. So
the only time he gets something wrong, it's always by accident.
He got it right.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like he slipped into
it. What was the quote about how many times does Trump have to prove?
Well, here it is.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, this is that you're setting it up perfectly. This was in Florida yesterday, and here's what's amazing, by the way. One of the events in Florida, in Tampa, it wasn't me. It was a Politico reporter who took a photo. It's like, it looked like maybe three dozen people in the room. He said, this has all the energy of a Tampa council city race, like city council seat race. That's how many people were there for Joe Biden in Tampa. At his big abortion speech, though, he had this to say, and it's hilarious. This screw up. Cut one.
In a sense, I don't know why we're surprised by Trump. How many times does he have to prove we can't be trusted?
And the crowd laughs because they can't help. It's an awkward laugh. How many times does he have to prove we can't be trusted? And I could just make that a Trump ad.
Yeah. Yeah. Here,
play it one more time. Cut one.
In a sense, I don't know why we're surprised by Trump. How many times does he have to prove we can't be trusted?
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
And you could just, on the screen, you could run that over and over again with a list of every court case, bogus court case that's been brought against Donald Trump as it sort of goes down the screen, reminding people that this is why we cannot be trusted. Yeah, exactly.
It's like, I'm Donald Trump, and I totally approve this tremendous message from Sleepy Joe.
I'm always impressed with you have a good Trump. I have the world's worst Trump impression because it's actually just me getting excited because I love whatever he says. And I'm just like, this is so great.
You really do.
But you actually have it's like a good studied
impression to some extent. Yeah.
I know who it is.
Right. There we go. I'm not. There's others who are much better, but people get the gist of where I'm going. So I just want to transition to the court cases that you just mentioned. This New York case is happening, and I know that some of our competitors in cable news just cannot get enough of it. And they're breaking down every single syllable of testimony. Nothing's really happening. We had Annie McCarthy here, and people know, I'm not a big Trump fan here, but these are misdemeanors at worst from years ago that have expired, that have lapsed, that this guy took a theory of the case that multiple other prosecutors had rejected and decided to go for it anyway and transformed hush money. It's a bad sordid situation, hush money to this porn star. Turned that into...
Nothing new, by the way.
Dozens of felony charges.
Yeah.
And they're like breathlessly, like panting. They can't get enough of it. Is it moving the needle at all?
No, because of course the sordid nature of all of it is it goes right over people's heads. They already know all of this. Mm-hmm. There's nothing new there. But every night I'll flip over for about 15, 20 minutes and I'll hit some of the other channels and I'll watch how they cover this stuff. And it's like their viewers are going to be so disappointed when they find out that signing an NDA with somebody is not a campaign violation. It's not a felony. They're going to be so disappointed. And quite frankly, I think that this is part of a larger scam by Democrats who are pissed off because they feel like they've lost the courts, and which was the only way they got some of their crazier stuff in on the books, and they want to discredit the courts. And so the best way to discredit the courts on both sides is to do stuff like this and have because conservatives or Republicans look at this and they're like, how do you have a prosecutor doing this? This is evil. This is using the court system for political purposes. And then when things work out the way they're supposed to work and the cases fall apart, Democrats are going to look at that and say, how did this happen? It's rigged because he didn't get convicted.
How is he above the law? Yeah. Here's my fear in this. Without a strong dog in the fight, I see this as totally political, this case, 100% political. Because it's a New York City jury with a judge who's literally a Biden donor. I mean, my gosh, he's a Biden donor judge running the case. That combination, they're going to convince quite possibly this jury to convict Trump. I think it probably doesn't survive down the line, scrutiny and appeal, but they don't care about that.
If Trump gets off
in 2025 or 2026 on appeal, if it serves the purpose of the brand, convicted felon, that's all they care about.
But here's the thing, and you do have a dog in this fight, and I get it. And even voters who don't particularly like Trump, they have a dog in this fight. Because if Democrats are allowed to win this way, they will never run an election any other way. This is the way they'll run elections.
New blueprint.
Yeah. I think they're good. When have Democrats ever exercised power and then stepped back away from the precipice if it worked? The only time they ever back down is when
it blows up in their face.
Right, it blows up in their face. But even then, like the nuclear option, that blew up in their face, and they were like, "Screw it, it almost worked," and they run for the
and they want to do more nuclear options. So, All right, we'll leave that conversation there for now. Charlie Hurd here in studio with us. He's the opinion editor over at the Washington Times, a Fox News contributor. And I think, Charlie, you have to go back to the hotel and go to sleep right now.
Yeah, exactly. For Fox and Friends. My bedtime is about 5:30.
All right, well, sleep very well. We'll see you on Fox and Friends, 6 a.m., bright and early tomorrow morning. Charlie, thanks for dropping by.
Great to see you.
We'll be right back. It's the Guy Benson Show. Keep it right here.
America is listening to the Guy Benson Show.
It's the Guy Benson Show here in New York, and this is the beauty of being in studio in New York. We had Charlie Hurd, who was on his way out. He's still here. And then our next guest for the next hour, she was here so early that she was just like our live studio audience for the previous segment.
Are you kidding me? Any party that Dagan McDowell walks into, I don't care if I'm leaving. I don't care how long. I'm sticking around.
You're staying. So we have both of you now here in studio. Hi, Dagan.
Hello, Guy.
It's very good to see you. We have like a minute and a half. I want to ask you this question. I saw there was like a piece in Semaphore about why all these left-wingers are outdoors still wearing masks. And they had their explanations for why. What is your theory on why they're still wearing masks outside?
You mean the ones protesting?
Yeah. The COVID masks.
Well, they don't want their faces to be seen. They don't want to wind up on the terror watch list. And they want to get jobs when they graduate. You saw Google just fired 50 people for protesting in Google offices in New York and out in Northern California. They don't want to be recognized because people are taking screen grabs of these nitwits faces, and actually that's an insult to actual nitwits, but we'll talk about this next hour, but they don't want their faces out there.
I think
there.
That's part of it. Charlie, the story also said that they, quote, deny the Biden administration's narrative about COVID, that it's no longer a big deal.
Yeah,
they're trying to say they still believe in the science of outdoor mask wearing.
Yeah,
so they're
exactly.
Anti-Semites and anti-science.
Yeah, it's everything Dagan just said, but it's also mental disease. I mean, I think a lot of these people would probably be wearing masks anyway, outside.
Yeah.
I mean, it's lunacy.
I just bought a copy of the DSM-5, so I'm going to go home and look that up.
I think some of it is just like tribal neurotic signaling. Like, this is what we do as like the in crowd. Hold that thought. Dagan McDowell will still be here when we come back. Charlie, who knows? Guy Benson Show.
A new generation of conservative talk. Right here, right now. Fair, fun, and backed by the trusted voices and reporting resources of Fox News.
Fox News.
You're listening to The Guy Benson Show. And now, here's your host, Guy Benson.
It's a new hour here on The Guy Benson Show in New York City. Thanks for tuning in. I'm on Gutfeld tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern, Fox News Channel. See you there. GuyBensonShow.com, our website here, and the podcast is always free. Fox News alert as we enter the second hour. The Dow down 36 points at the close, finishing up at 38,467. Also in New York City today is the Speaker of the House. And another Fox News alert. Mike Johnson of Louisiana is speaking right now live at Columbia University. He's speaking out against this anti-Semitic mob and the insane scenes on that Ivy League campus. He's doing it on campus, which is, I think, a very welcome sight. He's surrounded by other members of Congress as well. Let's listen to just a little bit of what he had to say literally moments ago.
So, thank you all for being here today. We have several members of Congress here, and we're here today at one of America's preeminent academic institutions on a very important day and a very important time. Throughout history, Columbia students have contributed to the great storybook of America's life and thought. Visionary American leaders like Alexander Hamilton and John Jay and the Jewish leader Gershom Sheshis knew the self-evident truth that was at the heart of this country at the heart of this university, and that is that we are endowed by our Creator with certain inalienable rights. They should not be infringed. The founders and the great leaders who had come through this institution in the past believed in religious liberty. They believed in democracy. They believed in morality and virtue and the dignity of every human person. They believed in the free exchange of ideas, and they detested mob rule. We are standing here right now on the steps of the Lowe Library. In this very building right behind us, Columbia University once awarded Winston Churchill an honorary degree, and it was Churchill who said, "It is manifestly right that Jews should have a national home where they may be reunited." We believe in that principle. And today I'm here to proclaim to all those who gnash their teeth and demand to wipe the state of Israel off the map and attack our innocent Jewish students this simple truth. Neither Israel nor these Jewish students on this campus will ever stand alone. Today, Hamas issued an endorsement statement of the protesters on this campus. They called them the future leaders of America. It is detestable. All of this has to be said because the cherished traditions of this university are being overtaken right now by...
So that's just a taste of Speaker Johnson. You could hear some of the hecklers in the background, but powerful words there. I had not heard about Hamas offering an endorsement of the Hamas mob. So the I guess, admiration is mutual between the student Hamas lovers and the Hamas Jew-killing terrorists themselves. But as the speaker pointed out, the founders of this country, quote, detested mob rule. And unfortunately, mob rule is what we've seen far too much of on Columbia's campus and elsewhere in recent days. With us here in studio is Dagan McDowell, anchor and analyst on Fox Business Network, co-host of The Bottom Line every weekday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Dagan, it's great to see you.
Great to see you.
Just your reaction to broadly what we're seeing and then the remarks here from the speaker.
This is not new, though. So every senior Hamas leader has already previously acknowledged the importance of the protest and influencing U.S. policy as part of its strategy to destroy Israel. Mm-hmm. This was written about in the Wall Street Journal commentary opinion pages by Steve Stalinsky earlier in the week. And to be clear, these new age Nazi campers on Columbia's campus and elsewhere, whether it's at NYU, we see confrontations at UT Austin, they are either unwittingly or knowingly instruments of and propagandists for terrorist groups. And it's Hamas, Hezbollah, the Houthis, all proxies of death to Israel, death to America, Iran. And the speaker mentioned Winston Churchill. Well, Joe Biden from day one in his appeasement of Iran, which funds all these terrorist groups, particularly Hamas that attacked Israel on October 7th, murdering women and women, families, and babies, Joe Biden is making Neville Chamberlain look like Winston Churchill in his, to quote Margaret Thatcher, the nauseating stench of appeasement, because that is all that they've done, funneling literally tens of $45 billion plus dollars through allowing the sale of oil by Iran. So this is all by design. It is by design from day one, and this is happening on these college campuses because it's allowed.
Yep. And I think it's refreshing to see the third highest ranking government official and the most important leader of Congress on the steps of the library at Columbia saying what he's saying, compared to President Biden, who was asked about it the other day. And he said, "Well, I condemn the anti-Semitic stuff, but I also condemn the people who don't understand what's happening to the Palestinians," like this. But really ham-fisted, pathetic, morally meaningless, and adrift both sides-ism.
Well, Joe Biden and his cronies like to talk about Biden's Catholicism, you know, cafeteria Catholic, as he was called. But you have to realize that where Speaker Johnson comes from, and he's standing next to Virginia Fox, Congresswoman from North Carolina, people down south, Baptist evangelicals, they stand shoulder to shoulder with the Jewish people and with the people of Israel. Israel is a holy place. It's referred to as the Holy Land, and the Jewish people are the chosen ones. That's how they are viewed by evangelicals and Baptists. That's how I was raised. I never heard a single anti-Jewish, anti-Semitic trope ever growing up in the South until I moved to New York City.
Interesting.
Yeah, so that's where that solidarity and support of Israel and the Jewish people, that's where a lot of that will come from, a deep faith, and encourage them to stand up.
And we're seeing now Virginia Fox, she is there, as are several members from the New York delegation.
Right.
These are Republican members showing up. There have been some really strong Democrats, Richie Torres, John Fetterman. There's been a handful of them who've been really outspoken. But then you've got the other side of it with the squad where they are, I mean, I think we've barely scratched the surface of their solidarity with the pro-Hamas crowd.
They're leading Biden in terms of appeasement. I said the appeasement of Iran is a large part of this by the Biden administration. But Joe Biden brought AOC, or AOC accompanied him to that Earth Day celebration, and she stood up there and talked about the peaceful protests
they
on all these campuses.
Hands. They held hands.
Exactly. And then Ilhan Omar, I just want to remind people what she wrote in 2012, quote, "Israel has hypnotized the world. May Allah awaken the people and help them see the evil doings of Israel." This is what she wrote. 2012.
All about the Benjamins.
She has been, that was in 2019. Yeah. She has been an open, proud, raging anti-Semite, and now she has raised a daughter to be one. And the people on Columbia's campus, one of whom was part of an organization that just in late March invited a known terrorist to do a seminar. He was via Zoom because he's probably doesn't want to come in this country. He's not even allowed in Germany. He was taking a photograph with Ilhan Omar's daughter because he was suspended after helping organize that Zoom seminar. So they're being encouraged by known terrorists, these Columbia students, to keep protesting in favor of Hamas, in favor of terrorism, and calling out for the destruction of Israel.
So applause to Speaker Johnson and these members for being there today. A student at Columbia who is Israeli will be our guest here in studio in the next hour. On the Guy Benson Show, we'll be right back. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
I'm Guy Benson. Welcome back. So I want to talk about something that happened earlier today. It comes on the heels of another development yesterday that was expected. We talked about it actually here on the show. So if you rewind to the weekend, the House passed the foreign aid bills that entailed money for Ukraine and Israel and Taiwan and a few other issues, one of which is a big one, not a small minor note, but I think something very significant. And if you listen to my exchange yesterday with Chip Roy, Texas congressman, if you missed it, you can go listen on the podcast or at GuyBensonShow.com. I made clear that I support the outcomes in these bills. They weren't all perfect, but I would have voted for all of them. Chip Roy voted no, I think for reasons that are defensible and understandable. We had that exchange. It passed the House on a bipartisan basis. Roughly 3 out of 4 Republicans voted yes. There were no votes in the dozens on the GOP side, no votes in the dozens on the D side as well. Then it went to the Senate. The Senate passed the legislation, the package, yesterday, overwhelmingly. Handful of Democrats voted no, some Republicans voted no, and then the majorities of both conferences voted yes. And so it went to the president's desk. That was the signing that occurred today. So that foreign aid will now be going to our allies, which on balance I think is a good thing. Totally get the point about our border. Totally get it. And whether the leverage piece was misplayed, I think Chip Roy makes a pretty compelling case on that front, admittedly. But another key element of this legislative package is now, as of today, the clock is officially ticking on TikTok. This was the component that we've been talking about. It's not an outright ban of TikTok, although it could end there. It is a requirement that the CCP-linked and controlled China-based parent company, ByteDance, has to liquidate TikTok in the United States, sell it, or it gets banned. And I believe the timeline is 9 months. Which was a compromise. I think initially it was 6 months. Some people were pushing for a year. Within a year, less than a year, that sale has to happen or TikTok goes away in the United States. And when you see just the squealing and the screaming from China, from ByteDance, controlled by the Chinese government, and you ask them, well, why can't you just sell and sever ties here in the United States? Right? Who doesn't want you to sell if you're asking some of these executives? The answer that they can't give is obvious. It's the Chinese Communist Party that views TikTok not as some sort of financial asset. They're not worried about the dollars and cents and what a sale could reap. I think they could make a killing. So many people are on TikTok. Kids are addicted to that app. Kids are addicted to that app. It's not about the money for China. It's not about the money for the Chinese Communist Party and their intelligence services and their military. It's about propaganda control inside the United States, and it's about espionage. They are stealing our data. They have access to everything in China. We've seen lots of reporting that despite their assurances and their carve-outs and all the things that they say publicly in their big multi-million dollar slick advertising campaign and their lobbying campaign inside the United States, huge dollars there, that all failed because ultimately the truth is this is a company controlled by China and they are pumping kids in this country full, their screens full of propaganda already. And if things ever got hairier, if things got tougher when it came to U.S.-China relations or some sort of, God forbid, war-type situation, you know the Chinese would be putting their thumb or their fist or their entire weight of their government on the scale to propagandize our youth. They've demonstrated that that's what they want to do and can do through this tool. And by the way, they have all sorts of restrictions within China on this product. So there's an education requirement. It has to be educational content inside the borders of China. Here, well, we know what it is here. So it's not about dollars and cents. This is an espionage and propaganda play by arguably the most significant adversary the United States has currently and in the foreseeable future in the world with very bad intentions for the world, and certainly for us. They want to replace us. They want to supplant us as the hegemon. And this is a huge tool in their arsenal, which is why they want no part of a sale. They want to keep it. But now, based on this legislation, they can't. That is a very good thing. That is a basic level, like, societal survival move by the United States. In a very unserious time, this is a rare moment of seriousness, and it was done on an overwhelming bipartisan basis, and I'm very glad for that. So now the ball is in TikTok's court, and we'll see how they react to all of it. Tick, 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 tick. There's a deadline. Now, I make that point independently. I think this is a very significant thing that has happened. I also, trigger warning for people in the audience who are Trump fans, I also have to say something about Trump. Because when he was president back in 2020, he signed an executive order doing exactly this. In fact, the timeline was a lot more collapsed. He gave TikTok 45 days to sell. If not, it would be banned. The app would be banned in the United States. That was an executive order. And it got struck down by the courts. But Trump tried to do this on his own. I think it was the right pursuit. I'm glad that Congress has done it. It's now signed by the president. You can make an argument, did Trump have single-handedly the power, the authority to do what he tried to do? The courts decided no, but the end goal, the instinct, was absolutely correct when he did it as president. But now that he's running for president again, and Biden's numbers look soft among young people for all sorts of different reasons, Trump is on Truth Social this week ripping into Biden for this. He wrote, just so everyone knows, especially the young people, crooked Joe Biden is responsible for banning TikTok. He is the one pushing it to close and doing it to help his friends over at Facebook. So this is the argument that he goes into, that it's like, oh, it's helping Facebook and Meta and some of these other companies he doesn't like in the U.S. because they're getting rid of a competitor. I think that is just blinkered and so short-sighted. I think a lot of this is just pandering. Pandering to young voters in a very clumsy, ham-fisted way, saying, you love your TikTok? Well, guess who took it away from you? Joe Biden. I'm all for criticizing and attacking Joe Biden when deserved, which is often. This is something that Trump himself tried to do as president, and now through the legislative process, it's been achieved on a bipartisan basis on Biden's watch. And to see Trump just flip because he's mad about the 2020 election and big tech, and that's part of the hook, and then also because he just wants to try to depress Biden's support among young people, this is now the direction that he's going. And I think it's wrong. I think it is unprincipled. I think it's bad. I think it's dumb. And again, I think it's short-sighted. So I had to get that in there. I think it's a mistake that Trump is making. I get why he's making it. I understand the thought process. I still think you have to put some of that aside and transcend partisan politics on certain big issues with massive stakes. This is one of them. And the Guy Benson Show returns after this break.
A fresh perspective on the topics of the day. It's Guy Benson.
Halfway through the Guy Benson Show, halfway through the broadcast week, we are in New York City for the next couple of days. Lots of TV duties, including Gutfeld tonight. Glad you're here. GuyBensonShow.com. Our podcast is always free. And with us now is David McCormick. He's the U.S. Senate nominee for the Republicans in Pennsylvania as of last night. Combat veteran, very successful businessman. He is challenging Bob Casey, the incumbent Democrat of multiple terms. Famous family name in that state. Dave, good to have you back on the show. Congratulations on officially becoming the nominee.
Hey, Guy. Thanks for having me. And I'm excited about it. You know, this is sort of ends one phase of the campaign and begins the next. I'm really honored to be our nominee. And, you know, this election, people always say every political cycle, this is the most important election of your lifetime. But I think this might be the one. You know, the country is very fragile. The consequences of getting it wrong, so significant. And I think people are really feeling like they have to engage. And certainly that's the case in Pennsylvania, where I'm up against a long-term incumbent, Bob Casey, 18 years in the Senate, and really represents, I think, what's going wrong with the country, the status quo that's led to, really sky-high inflation, a border crisis, crime in our cities like Philadelphia that's spiraling out of control, and a war on natural gas, which is the key economic driver in Pennsylvania. So this is a little bit of a microcosm of what's going on in the country, a campaign that is, you know, the past versus the future and leadership versus followership. And I'm feeling good support on the ground.
So I want to talk a bit about the primary. You won just overwhelmingly. You were obviously kind of the nominee in waiting, so that was a foregone conclusion. But I look at the results from last night across the board in your state, and I see potentially some red flags in terms of turnout and enthusiasm. I know that at the top of the ticket, it's a fait accompli on both sides, so of course participation is going to be significantly down. But Republicans did not come out in the numbers that Democrats did. And if you look on the Republican side, look, Biden has his issues with the unaffiliated vote or the uncommitted vote and people protesting that way. But on the Republican side, you have Donald Trump, who won running away. Of course, he's the only person left in the race. But Nikki Haley got out of this race 6 weeks ago, 7 weeks ago. She still pulled 155,000 votes of Republican voters in a closed primary. Obviously, there are still some people within the party not necessarily feeling all the unity yet, maybe ever. I just wonder, you can only control your campaign. What is your message to Trump supporters and to, let's say, Haley supporters or people who are reticent about Trump? What's your message to them, be they Republicans, independents, or even Democrats?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. I think first, what we're seeing across the board here is that Pennsylvania is becoming redder. And just to put in perspective, 2016, there was 1 million more registered Democrats and Republicans when Trump won. And today there's less than 400,000 more registered Democrats. And that number's closing. I think we'll probably be at 300,000 by Election Day. I think so we're becoming redder. By 2028, we'll be a red state. And that's a critical advantage and opportunity for us that I plan to take advantage of. I think the turnout, you know, we see time and again when President Trump's at the top of the ticket, the turnout is very significant. This primary, I think, because you didn't have any real conflict at the top of the ticket because, you know, President Trump was unopposed, I was unopposed, I think that dampened turnout. But I am very confident in November we're going to have an enormous turnout, similar to 2016 or 2020. And the reason is 80% of Pennsylvanians think the country's going in the wrong direction. And those aren't just Republicans. Those are Democrats and independents. Final point. Yeah, we've got about 11% of the electorate in Pennsylvania that's independent. And those independents in particular are deeply unsettled by the direction of the country. And I think there's a real opportunity for us to be able to take advantage of that and encourage them to weigh in November in a way that that helps get President Trump and me across the finish line.
Okay.
I think his interest and my interest are very aligned. His interests are my interests are aligned with his because he gets a big turnout in these rural counties. And frankly, I'm able to appeal to some voters that may not necessarily come out for the president, but will come out for me and could be a real advantage for him. So that's how I see the landscape. And, you know, it's a matter of making our case. And that's what I'm doing right now across our Commonwealth, talking to people about our future and what real leadership will look like.
Okay. And I want to come back to the path to victory in just a second. But it's already started and they've had a head start because there wasn't a contested primary in your race. The left is coming after you. They're trying to paint you various ways. In 2022, you had Dr. Oz, who lost to John Fetterman. And from the beginning, they were saying Oz is out of touch. He's not really from here. He's from New Jersey, all of that kind of stuff. They're trying to run that playbook with you to an extent as well on your residency. I know there was a major newspaper looking into your life story and saying, oh, has he not been honest with us about his background here in Pennsylvania? Oh, look at this rich guy. We know that they use that as an epithet, unless it's one of their rich guys. How do you plan to combat what they have been throwing and telegraphing at you and then what's clearly coming as an onslaught very soon?
Yeah, listen, I mean, politics is a contact sport. And when you have the economy the Democrats have, which is, you know, 60% of Pennsylvanians are suffering in wages that aren't keeping up, or where you have this border crisis that's spiraling out of control, you know, what do? You go after, you try to manufacture and go after the life story of your opponent. I'm extremely comfortable with my life story. Seventh generation Pennsylvanian. I grew up outside of Scranton. I played football. I wrestled. My folks had a farm. We lived in town. My dad was the college president, and I baled hay and trimmed Christmas trees and was a paper boy and wrestled and played football, and wrestling got me to West Point. And then I served for 9 years in the military, went to graduate school, came back to Pennsylvania, eventually ran a company that created 600 jobs in Pennsylvania, then went to serve my country again. So my life story is what we hope for our kids. I mean, I've ended up being much more successful than I ever expected. I had much more financial security and much more wealth than I ever imagined I would. That's what we want for our kids, and I'm really proud of it. I had a lot of luck, and you know, it was based on having great parents and born in a great country. And so I'm going to lean in to my story. I'm proud of it. I've always represented my history honestly and accurately. I've written a book about it that included my life story, which I wrote long before I ran for office this time around. So I feel very comfortable about that, and I think it's a miscalculation. I think that's not going to stick because it's not true, and my history and my service to country is beyond question.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting. They're kind of trying to frame you up, at least in one of the attacks, as like a child of privilege who was very connected growing up, and I know you can deal with that independently, but also, are they aware of your opponent? I mean, this is so rich. Your opponent's a career politician who inherited political fame from his dad.
That's the best part. There was this New York Times. Anytime you have the New York Times doing an attack piece on you when you're the Republican nominee, I think that's a good sign. It means you're over the target. And in my case, I have two parents that were public school teachers. And I've said publicly they were public school teachers. And then my dad went on and was the president of Bloomsburg State College, which had been a teacher's college. And this New York Times reporter wrote this in a story as if to suggest that somehow because my dad had become a college president, I was deeply political connected and benefited from that. And the fact that they would make that reference without even mentioning the fact that Bob Casey was the son of this extremely prominent Democratic governor and his entire political resume is essentially that he was the son of Bob Casey Sr.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the world we're living in, unfortunately. Now, the good news is nobody reads that story and thinks that's a real thing, and nobody trusts the New York Times. And that's a sad state of affairs for our media. But I'm quite confident that when you look at the pictures of me graduating at West Point and being all-state football player and, you know, marching in the parade in Bloomsburg when I came home from the Gulf War. People know I'm a Pennsylvanian, and they're not going to believe the BS that that the Democrats and the media are throwing at me. And unfortunately, if you want to serve, you got to be willing to stand in the arena and take the shots. And because they don't have anything real to criticize, they're going to make stuff up. And that's just part of the game.
Your resume is impressive. Your story that you just relayed is what it is. That's who you are. That's where you come from. But do you have any close relatives who were cannibalized?
That's the best part. Right about the time that they were quibbling with the fact that I had said that I had two parents that were school teachers, President Biden said that his uncle had been eaten by cannibals. So this is the which by the way was not presented as the incredible faux pas it was by the New York Times. And you got to have a little bit of a sense of humor to be in politics these days, because if you take this stuff too seriously, you'll drive yourself crazy. I know why I'm doing this. There's a lot of things I could do with my life right now. I've been very fortunate. I am honored to be the nominee. I would be honored to serve, because I think we're in trouble. And duty, honor, country, what I learned at West Point, this is the time. And so that's why I'm in it, and that gives me a lot of peace, no matter what people say about it.
We have seen this roiling and rolling explosion of anti-Semitism and, frankly, anti-Americanism on college campuses in a lot of these hate rallies. A lot of it has been based here in New York City, but it's spreading. One of the congressional cheerleaders for all of this, a member of the squad whose record is just atrocious on these issues and others, is this woman, Summer Lee, who Democratic voters in the primary in your state, Western Pennsylvania, saw fit to renominate her. She had a spirited campaign from someone much more reasonable, but the Democrats said, nope, we want the squad member. We like this anti-Semitic person, and so she'll be the nominee again. You aren't running against her, but your opponent in the Senate race has a tie there, doesn't he?
He really does. Yeah, this is, well, first, on the campuses, an absolute disgrace. An absolute disgrace. These kids don't know the difference between right and wrong, good and evil. And you say, how could it happen? And then you see that testimony on Capitol Hill with those three college presidents. You say, that's how it happened. You know, the lack of leadership, the lack of moral clarity.
Yep.
And the same is true with Bob Casey, to your point. Bob Casey's trying to have it both ways. I'm a strong supporter of Israel, he says. I'm opposed to anti-Semitism, he says. And then he doesn't have the courage to withdraw his endorsement for Summer Lee, who's my congresswoman. I live in Squirrel Hill in Pittsburgh. He not only doesn't withdraw it, he doubles down on it. So here we have this senator who doesn't demonstrate the leadership, doesn't demonstrate the moral clarity, doesn't call someone out in his own party who is clearly anti-Semitic. It's a disgrace, and that's the problem.
Well, it's not that he didn't call her out. He endorsed her.
Right.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh,
absolutely. So he has not had the courage to stand tall. And this is honestly his MO. This is how he operates. You will never see Bob Casey standing up and taking a hard position. He will hunker down. I keep his head down, see which way the wind's blowing. And then it'll come up, but he tries to have it both ways. My mom's from Punxsutawney, and I make the joke, he's Punxsutawney Bob, because you don't even see him except in every 6 year when it's election time. And
He sees his shadow and runs back into the cave.
Exactly. On the tough issues, he is not going to stand tall. And this is an issue where obviously the Democratic Party's very divided. I think it's horrific the direction the progressive left is taking the party and the country. I do think it's anti-patriotic. You can see that in the survey data for young people. Only about a third of young people are very patriotic. We see it in the recruitment numbers for our military. This is part of an ideology that questions America's greatness, that defines America's history, is one grounded in racism, as opposed to recognizing that we had dark chapters in our national history, but we've always overcome them and moved forward, and that we're the greatest country in the face of the earth in terms of liberty and freedom and, you know, free enterprise and the ability to pursue your dreams. And when you hate America, when you don't recognize America's greatness, it takes you down a path. When you define the world as oppressed and oppressors, you get twisted into pretzels saying ridiculous things like these kids on campus are saying. So I'm really terribly worried about it. I think it's evidence of a spiritual decline in our country. I don't mean religious as much as just a deterioration of values. And I think the only way we turn that around is leadership. and getting the right people in there that'll say tough things and get our country back on track.
Dave McCormick, I agree with that. The question is, can you win this race? And if so, how do you win this race? I want to challenge you on some of the polling that we're seeing and get your analysis moving forward as soon as we come back after this short break on The Guy Benson Show.
In the swamp, not of the swamp. Guy Benson.
Back with you here on The Guy Benson Show. Glad to have you listening. Dave McCormick is our guest who stuck with us through the break. He is the Senate nominee for the Republicans in the state of Pennsylvania. All right, finally, on the electability question and the path forward here, because I think you're, of course, right about your opponent. Bob Casey is this unremarkable rubber stamp with a famous last name, and he never puts his neck out there. He never does much of anything, and yet that has worked pretty well for him. He's been elected multiple times. People know the name even if they don't really know him. And he's going to have a ton of money, lots of name recognition, just the inertia of being there for so long. And when you look at polling, which I do probably too much, in Pennsylvania, you've got President Trump, depending on what survey you look at, he's down a point, tied, up a point, up 3 points, but very, very close. And I think on average leading slightly, Trump is in your state. In those same surveys, often you're lagging behind Trump by 7, 8, 9 points and trailing by a modest but clear margin to the incumbent. To what do you attribute that gap where you're underperforming Trump, at least right now? And what's your plan to close the gap and win?
Yeah, well, sort of stepping back from this, it's an unbelievably bad environment for Bob Casey to be incumbent. 80% of the Pennsylvanians think the country's in the wrong direction. 70% can't recognize a single thing about Bob Casey. He's a very weak incumbent. In my case, when people know me and know Bob Casey, they vote for me. So informed voters vote for me. The problem is less than 50% of Pennsylvanians know me. I've been a business guy. I've never run for a political office except in 2022. It was a Republican primary. So the name of the game for winning the campaign is raising my name ID and showing the contrast between a guy who hasn't done anything in political life and it can be tied to all the bad decisions that have led to our current crisis and someone who's been a leader in the military and business his entire life and doesn't know anybody anything is going to be able to accept the people of Pennsylvania, is going to be able to fight for them. So that's the strategy. Raise my name ID. I'm going to campaign, and I'm campaigning aggressively in the 55 counties that are Republican counties because the name of the game there is turnout. President Trump helps a lot. There's 12 counties that are blue or purple, and the name of the game there is to move persuadable voters. And the persuadable voters are independents and conservative Democrats and key minority communities. I don't have to win those. I just have to move some of those voters in my direction.
Right, margins. Places matter the most, especially in some of those deep blue areas. And it is such an important state, of course, at the presidential level, but very much in the Senate map as well. If Dave McCormick becomes a senator, there is a 99% chance, in my mind, Republicans have retaken the Senate, maybe with some breathing room as well. Crucial race, one of the handful across the country, which is why we have spent the time that we have with Dave McCormick, who is the freshly minted official Republican nominee for the United States Senate in the Keystone State. Dave McCormick, PA.com, his campaign website, if you're interested. Dave, really appreciate the conversation. I'm sure we'll talk again soon.
Always great to be with you, Guy. Thank you.
Final hour of the Guy Benson Show coming up next. We have a guest here in studio. He is a current student at Columbia University. He is also Israeli. His story, in his own words, next.
Raise your glass to the Guy Benson Show Happy Hour. Brought to you by the Finnish Long Drink. Finland's most popular alcoholic beverage is taking America by storm. Visit thelongdrink.com. And now, here's Guy Benson.
It's It's the final hour here on the Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday edition from the Big Apple today and tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com, that's our website. Podcast is always free as soon as the show is over. Catch me tonight on Gutfeld, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, Fox News Channel. That'll be a blast. I'll see you there. Here on the radio this hour, sponsored by the Finnish Long Drink. It's our happy hour, and they're terrific. It's an alcoholic product, so 21 plus only. Always drink responsibly, thelongdrink.com. Well, I am pleased to be joined here in studio by a student at Columbia University, and we've been talking about what's happening on that campus and, frankly, a lot of other campuses. It's spreading. But the nexus of this, ground zero at the moment, has been this Ivy League school here in Manhattan in New York City, and it has been very, very ugly. And my guest is Jewish. He's Israeli. And Columbia, for a long time, was his dream school. And he ended up there. And it's become, for obvious reasons, something of a nightmare. And we're going to call him Ethan. It is great to see you and meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, nice to meet you, and thank you for having me.
So just give us your background a little bit on what brings you to the city. I know that you had dreams of attending Columbia one day. You attained that dream. Before we get to what's happened since and recently, just give us a bit of background about yourself, if you would.
So I'm 20 years old, international student at Columbia University. And since ever, my dream was to be a physician. I really wanted to be a cardiothoracic surgeon. And I can't really explain why, beside the fact that Columbia University or New York generally is the home of many, most of the best cardiothoracic departments are located in New York. And I wanted to break limits. I wanted to go and receive the best education I could and I can. And unfortunately, now it's kind of like questionable. But I started my medical career as a volunteer in Tel Aviv Medical Center in the pediatric ER. Eventually, I finished there. I transferred to the adult ER, and I trained as an EMT for Magen David Adom, which is like the ambulances and emergency organization that Israel. It works a bit differently in Israel. We do a lot of. We don't have many companies. It's all under one umbrella. And when I needed to join the military as part of the mandatory military service, I volunteered to the special forces. I trained as a fighter and a commander of the medical team. I also trained as a special forces EMT. And I was able to use my military skills to save lives. My main concern was to develop method of how to sustain patient in war zones, but at the same time, how to treat anyone. I didn't care if it was, non-Israeli, like someone that is not Israeli or not a soldier. And I was very lucky to be part of humanitarian mission that rescued casualties from the civil war in Syria and treated, innocent people that got hurt during this horrible war. So
I didn't see a lot of protests and yelling about genocide during the Syrian civil war and what was happening to the people of Syria. That's been reserved strangely for one specific instance in one specific country where the word genocide, I think, has just been completely abused to the point of making it meaningless. There's also this lie, this slander that the IDF is just bloodthirsty killers, committing all these atrocities, killing all these civilians. Based on your time in the IDF and specifically what you did on the medical side, speak to that.
I can tell you from firsthand, in compared to those people who protest right now outside, that I lived there. I treated people there, rescuing and actively putting my life endangering my life to save people that from a country that considered to be an enemy country. I didn't care. And if you will speak with Israelis or Jewish people, no one cares. No, people want peace. No one like, I don't know anyone who comes and say, I resist to Palestine, I resist to Palestinian people. And no one even, like, I haven't heard people who say, don't protest for Palestine. We are here because we want to live peacefully, safely. And I saw it, when I served, when I needed to treat terrorists and take their, a terrorist that was injured when she tried to stab soldiers. I came with, in one of my, like, one hand I had a gun, one hand I had a defibrillator. I took the knife out and we treated her. Because my job and what I'm, like, you know, qualified to do is to save, like, is saving life. That's what I need to do.
Even if it's a terrorist who just attacked soldiers.
If the terrorist, she wasn't a threat at the moment, yes, Israel and the IDF operates under international laws. We have Democrat, very advanced court and a legal system, and we need to follow the protocols. Now, I don't say that everything is perfect and there is a lot of place to criticize.
Of course.
But generally, as a system, to compare the IDF to Hamas is ridiculous. And that's why we're here.
Yes, I, of course, agree with that. And people compare the IDF unfavorably to Hamas or to even the Nazis. It's so unbelievably insulting. I want to ask you this question before we get to present day New York City and Columbia. October 7th. How did that affect you personally?
Wow. I think, I'm kind of speechless when it comes to October 7, because I remember I was awake and I heard the conversation when people called the news channels to report that there are, stuck in a burning house when they could hear the shooting before they got murdered.
Were you here or in Israel?
I was here. I lost a lot of friends. And I still have one of my friends' father is still kidnapped in Gaza for 202 or 203 days. And my heart is truly broken. And since then, we saw a very concerning trend in Columbia University, especially when people support Hamas and, some of them even justify what happened. And I have a picture of, like, on the tents right now when they explain how resistance is legit in any matter.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, it doesn't work like that. But I must say at the same time that I heard a lot of people from the other side, condemn those actions. So I do have hope that there is a place for a healthy dialogue. But since October 7, my dream started to crumble down and started to, from being the thing that I'm, like, the most proud of to be something that I'm not ashamed of, but, like, I don't want to be in campus. I paid all of my money and all of my parents' pension to attend this school. And suddenly...
So you don't come from wealth and money. You actually work.
I come from a not low-income family, but we don't have money. Like, my parents doesn't have their own.
So this took a huge amount of effort on your part and sacrifice just to get here. My guest is an Israeli at Columbia University. He's a student. We're calling him Ethan in this conversation. And I want to get into what you are witnessing on your campus when we come back. It's The Guy Benson Show.
New talk for a new generation. The Guy Benson Show.
We continue. It's The Guy Benson Show. With me in studio here in New York City is a current Columbia student. We're calling him Ethan. And now what we're hearing from some Jewish students and faculty and others at Columbia is, and the rabbi, for example, who came out over the weekend with Passover approaching, saying it's unsafe for Jewish people on that campus. And the response comes from sort of the pro-Hamas mob. That's not true. They're exaggerating. Look, we have some Jews here with us, protesting with us. They're not unsafe. These other people are just making it up or exaggerating. What has your experience been?
Oh, I love that. That's a good, it's a deep and broad conversation. I think since the Holocaust, anti-Semitic actions, or the word anti-Semitic, is kind of like a taboo. You can't say it. But Colombia, kind of like in those radical movement, shifted the mind, kind of created a new slang of anti-Zionism doesn't mean anti-Semitic.
Right.
And it's okay. Have you seen on the videos when people are, it looks like a cult, that they pushed away Zionist people when they are
chanting together.
Well, they're completely synchronized with their speech and repeating after one.
Very creepy.
Very creepy. So being anti-Zionist is legit. But if you support Israel, it's not even, you know, it's not, it isn't about Judaism. It is about Judaism. It's if you support Israel, or if you're not condemn Israel, you can be part of this camp. You can be part of this side. But if you're a Jewish that doesn't, stand loudly against the state of Israel, you can't be part of us. You need actively to call for the destruction of Israel.
And then you're in.
And then you're in.
And if not, you're one of the bad Jews and you're not welcome. Is that different than a lack of safety? Because I've seen videos that are very disturbing. I read a piece from one of your fellow students who was assaulted by this mob. When they say the threat is exaggerated,
no.
Why do you say it's not exaggerated?
Because when you sing constantly intifada, intifada, look at the definition of intifada. Mm-hmm. Listen, my grandmother, she's a Holocaust survivor. I fought for this country for 10 years, you know, in my way, and almost 10 years. And we can just spread, like, look what happened globally. Look on the trends. Like, Jewish constantly are threatened, regardless of the situation of Israel. Before the existence of Israel, you know, the Holocaust happened, and 6 million Jews were brutally murdered because of their religion. And when I try to speak with those, you know, extreme, like those people who scream and chant for the destruction of Israel, and they always bring up the word Islamophobia as a contra argument to anti-Semitic events. And I try to ask them, seriously, there are two Muslim people who live in Israel peacefully. You saw, like, under the massive Iranian attack, you saw Israeli defense systems intercept rockets above Misgad al-Aqsa, that, you know, so important for the Muslims.
You said there are Muslims living in Israel. You said it's 2 million, right?
Yeah.
2 million.
I think there are almost 2 million.
Yeah.
Muslims.
No, yeah. That's a huge number of people. And they kind of just
a lot.
Discount them. They just sort of wipe them out of the conversation somehow.
I have many friends who are Arabs in Israel. My mom, most of my mom's employees are Muslim people. And I love them. I celebrate Ramadan with them. My grandmother, she's from Libya. We speak and we have so much in common, which, you know, make it even more frustrating that no one is willing to listen to find the common denominator.
Yeah, what do they say? If you try to explain that to them, it sounds like there's really no communication happening at this point. But if you've tried to engage, how do they process what you're telling them, or do they just call you a liar? The fact that you're Israeli, they must really, some of them have a problem with that.
Automatically, since I'm Israeli and you can't miss it by my accent, they shut me down. They are not willing to speak. I'm also gay. So when I try to speak with the LGBTQ+ community and try to explain that they probably, you know, they can be gay in Gaza, it's like they probably would be executed, you know.
They would be executed.
Yeah, probably. And in Israel, it's the only place in the Middle East that they can celebrate pride. The only response I received was, shut up, you Nazi. Mm. And I was like, how can you call me a Nazi when I'm a Jewish? And, you know, I said, like, you know, I tried to to say, I'm my grandmother, she's an Holocaust survivor, but no one was willing to listen. And when you try to say and find a reaction about the missile attack and say that the only casualty, when my heart is truly broken, is a 7-year-old Muslim girl.
This is Iran's attack on yes. Israel. Yeah.
Where are you? Where is your reaction? Why, instead of push us away to make so many people so concerned that they're not willing to come on campus? Why can't you, as the next leadership, and us as the next leadership from both sides, to come together and speak and talk and find how we can, you know, solve? And we all, like, I'm open, and everyone I know is open for criticism. And I don't think you would ever, and I think it was also in the hearing that President Shafiq, you won't hear like protest against Palestinian people. You won't find people condemn Palestinian people or celebrating the death or, you know, glorifying horrible things. The opposite. We want to find a solution. We all think that the Palestinian people should have a place to live in. I think that coexistency is the main thing that we need to, you know, focus on, instead of keep fighting and alienate so many people and, you know, attract so many hostile, I'm trying to be very, like, cautious with my mm-hmm. word, but so many, like, hostile people and shift minds to be so radical, instead of find and promote, you know, a dialogue, something so...
Well, it seems like two points on being gay and being attacked as a Nazi by just pointing out that Israel protects gay rights and the neighborhood otherwise generally does not. They call that pink washing, which is crazy. They're like, oh, because you have gay rights in your country, you're using that as a cover for your genocide or whatever. It's just like a brain worms thing. I can't process the Queers for Palestine movement and that whole hostile attitude that they gave you, and they're very open about it. But in terms of dialogue and finding solutions, I think the cynical but probably correct answer, not for all of them but for many of them, is they don't want a dialogue. They don't want a solution. Their solution is the annihilation of the Jewish state. That's their solution. There is no two-state interest. Hamas rejects it. Many of these people openly support Hamas. Therefore, when they chant from the river to the sea, they know what they mean. Some of them are idiots and ignorant. They don't know. But a lot of them know exactly what they're chanting for, and they mean it. I know you want to respond to that. Our guest here in studio in New York is a current Columbia student. Hold that thought. We'll return after this.
Not the same talking points here. The Guy Benson Show.
Back on The Guy Benson Show in New York City. In studio with us is a current student at Columbia University in the Ivy League. We're calling him Ethan. He is Israeli, and he's been witnessing all of this madness firsthand for weeks. And right before the break, I was making the point that a lot of the people who are chanting these horrible things, some of them have no idea. It's just drones, right? They're going along with the crowd. Others are acutely aware of what they're saying in the meeting behind it. And I just wanted to get your response.
I agree, but I also want to say, like, I agree, yep, but there are so many people that don't know what they're chanting for.
True, absolutely true.
I think
true.
That they were able to find a lot of people that came from a background of discrimination. I think they were able to find a lot of people who felt reject and suddenly found comfort and, like, affiliation to be part of a community that accept them, you know, without... Like, just come, just be part as long as you go against the state of Israel.
Right, it gives them some meaning, and it's a sort of a tribal thing, and they feel like they belong and they're doing something.
I don't think that they really know what happens. And that's, like, the most, like, frustrating thing that, you know, Colombia, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to pretend and go to this school, is that I believe that those institutions and the connection that, you know, people are, like, that you can create in this kind of institution will lead to a better future. I believe that the next president, the next Congress member, the next CEO of a global bank, like, are currently sitting in classes at Columbia University, and we want to work toward a better like world. I want to support a common dialogue. And I never, and no one ever told them to stop protesting. It's just the way you choose to do that. Like the way that they actively, you know, push us away. And I don't see those like radical movement that promote and support and organize those like protests actively condemn the like Intifada songs.
No.
Or like,
no, they don't do anything. They sing the songs. They chant the chant, globalize the Intifada. I saw the huge sign at the encampment on your campus, globalize the Intifada. They had photos glorifying known terrorists. Some of the people know exactly what they're doing. Others, though, to your point, you're right. A lot of them have no idea. They're there for the excitement of it all. This was from NYU, so downtown from Columbia, but same city. This video is going around today. These are students being asked why they were protesting. Cut 15.
And what would you say is the main goal with tonight's protest?
I think the goal is just showing our support for Palestine and demanding that NYU stop. I honestly don't know all of what NYU's doing.
Is there something that NYU's doing?
I really don't know. I'm pretty sure they're... Do you know what NYU's doing?
About what?
About Israel. Why are we protesting here?
Palestine will be free!
I was more educated.
I'm not either. I came from Columbia. I was there up at Columbia, and we came down. They said NYU students needed our support. So I came down. I heard there's lots of cops. Some people were saying it was getting dangerous.
All right, so I wish I knew what we were protesting. Do you know? I don't know. I wish I were more educated. Me too. That's kind of funny to some extent, and it makes me almost a little bit feel relief.
I'm smiling because I'm scared.
It's both disturbing because of the indictment of what that says. It's also still that ignorance is better, I think, than being steeped in pro-Hamas sentiment where you genuinely are rooting for terrorists. But that's still pretty bleak.
It's insane because I'm trying to look at the bigger picture, you know, and globally listen to what's being said on those protests. They, like a lot of them calls, like, and resist to the Western civilization. They call against America, yeah, against Europe. And what will happen when this like propaganda weapon, you know, will be pointed on America or on other countries despite of Israel? Or what will happen when the, you know, administration won't be so supportive to some community, like, you know, for some communities? What will happen like in 30 years or 40 years when it's so easy to manipulate and shape the mind of like the those students? That should be, and like, you know, it's kind of like that should be the alert for everyone,
yes,
that something is wrong in the system, that something is gonna, like, something is hiding in the not that far future.
Yeah, I think 30 years might be optimistic. This could come a lot sooner. And a lot of the people, the hardcore folks who hate Israel, almost all of them also hate America. And in the Middle East, they call Israel the little Satan. They call us, in some of these quarters, the great Satan. And of course, there are many people, for example, the people of Iran hate the regime. And yet you have people in this country rooting for the regime that throws gay people off of roofs and hangs them and kills women if they take their headscarves off. And you have people who call themselves progressive at some of the most elite institutions in the country like yours, just overtly rooting for this oppressive theocratic regime in Tehran. It's just, it's completely backwards. And I keep thinking, if you can have young people in the United States hear about October 7th, see what happened on October 7th, and then instantly decide that the victim is actually the bad guy, if people can be convinced of that, they can be convinced of anything.
Every time that something bad happens in the protest or something go a bit like too far, they just, oh, those are Zionists to try to shift the majority away from us. The videos from October 7 massacre are it's completely fabricated. It's all AI. I've seen everything. People just like are not willing to listen. You know, it's insane.
Now you can say you specifically lost multiple friends. And they say that you're lying? Like,
so many. Constantly, every day, I try to explain. I believe that our job, because it's also very important to mention that there are so many people that support us. It's just not, you know, so urged, like, so, like, it's not, they don't want to go and shout with Israeli flags, we support Israel. But I received a lot of emails and, like, messages that support Israel.
From students?
Students, professors, okay. A lot of the STEM departments that I had the pleasure to work with. Like, I've seen a lot. And also there are a lot of people in the middle. And my job is not to, you know, our job is not to try and convince them to stop supporting Palestine. Our job is to, you know, tell them the truth, to show them really what happened, and find to bring the two sides to speak, to engage with each other, to find a solution. Because screaming intifada, that won't get us...
Yeah, intifada is killing Jews. So when they're screaming that and they're wanting another expanded intifada, that is extremely menacing, threatening language, given the meaning of that word in the history of what has been done under the auspices of that word and that term. Before I let you go, what do you think needs to happen at Columbia to at least get this somewhat back under control? And do you plan to stay there? Are you going to try to stick it out and graduate, or are you looking to leave? What's your plan?
So I think that Columbia should, eventually Columbia should step up and condemn and try to shift those violent protests into something that hopefully will lead to a healthy dialogue and to find a solution and talk and, you know, nurture a friendship and work as a community together in an elite institution instead of separate between us. Because the hybrid situation that Jewish are, you know, studying from home while everyone can go on campus, it's ridiculous. Why can't I enjoy the dining halls, the libraries, everything that I paid, everything and more than what I have to be, you know, to enjoy those
amenities and yeah those facilities.
But I can't. So I think Colombia, like the fact that they're negotiating, in what world, like something is that it's peaceful, you know, would go to negotiate and like it shouldn't be there. So I think we need to speak. We need to find a common denominator, to find a solution, to speak, to engage with each other, to explain the frustration of both sides, and be able to eventually lead and promote agendas that supports both sides. Because we are here, Jewish people are here, Israelis. Like Israel is a country and it will continue to stand and be a prosperous nation that brings a lot of good, Israel does a lot of good things as well that we need to recognize. So I'm not going to let them win. I'm not going to find myself another education. Colombia has one of the best programs in the world for what I'm studying. And I also believe that we need to fight for our voices and we need to promote peace, because I want to speak with those protesters. I want to sit with them over coffee and explain the situation. I don't want to fight. I don't want to stand with, you know, with flags and chanting on microphones and, you know, and speakers against each other. I want to sit. I want to talk. I want to engage with a deep conversation that it's not biased. And we are all willing to do so. I feel like I'm representing now the Zionists, the majority of the like Israelis, students, and we would love to see, to engage, to promote education, to promote science, to promote, you know, so many aspects.
Yeah, but it has to be mutual, and the other side has to want that too. And right now, it looks like many of them really want something that looks like the opposite, and that's what you're confronting every day. Exactly. On this campus, which has been just stomach turning to watch on the screens. I can only imagine what it's like living through it, feeling like you can't even be safely welcome on your own campus that you're paying to attend in the United States of America within months of a genocidal slaughter of Jewish people by terrorists. It's just so backwards. It's made me angry. We've been talking about it here ever since. And we're really glad that you were willing to come in here and have this conversation with us, for our audience to hear your voice and hear your story. Ethan, thank you for what you're doing. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me, and I sincerely hope that we will be able to find a common denominator and speak and talk and find a solution for both people, both sides.
It's the Guy Benson Show. Some reflections on all of this in the home stretch next.
Miss a minute, miss a lot. The Guy Benson Show.
Home stretch on the Guy Benson Show. Thanks for tuning in. GuyBensonShow.com. Podcast always free when the show is over, just minutes from now. You can also check out FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll be on Gutfeld tonight, 10 p.m. Eastern, Fox News Channel. So set your DVR or please tune in. Well, that was really quite a conversation with this young man. And it's just unfathomable to me that somehow he feels like the type of person who can't be on campus, who isn't really welcome or safe. I mean, yes, you can see the frustration and the anger, and there's some obvious bitterness and resentment from some of these folks saying, and he was making the point himself, I spend so much money at this school. He said, my family doesn't come from money. Unlike, by the way, a lot of these Nepo baby, super rich kids who got into school because of mom and dad or the family history, their legacies at Columbia. This guy is not one of those. And right now, he isn't welcome. He doesn't feel safe on his own campus because of this mob that hates him. And they especially hate him because he's not just a Jew, he's an Israeli Jew. And he served in the IDF, which is required of Israeli citizens. And the fact that he was out there saving lives, including Muslim lives, they don't care. Some people are just impervious to any of that. The hatred, the agenda, the extremism just consumes them and robs them of any ability to really think critically. And unfortunately, the people around them who buy into it slowly atrophy in that ability as well. And it just struck me that he kept coming back despite the frustration, despite all of those negative feelings. He keeps wanting to come back to the point we should be able to talk. I wish I could just have coffee with them and not shout and, you know, have ping pong slogans back and forth. I want to just talk things through and talk about my life and talk about their life and figure out some sort of solution. That is, I think, valuable. I think that is admirable. But in order to do that, it takes the old cliche, two to tango. And when the other side not only doesn't want to do that, they want to scream and call him a killer and someone responsible for genocide and all this stuff. I don't know where you go from there. And that's something that he is grappling with and others like him in that position at Columbia and elsewhere every day. Meanwhile, and this is very much related because it's like I asked him about October 7th a few times because that is the starting point of the current conflict. Hamas attacked Israel in this horrific way. And in addition to the burning and the cutting and the bombing and the shooting and the murder and the rape, they also kidnapped hostages. Dozens of them remain in Gaza. We hope alive, including five Americans, one of whom is a young man named Hirsch Goldberg Pollan. And I interviewed his parents on Fox and Friends just weeks ago. And they were, of course, desperate and scared and hopeful and all of those things. And I remember thinking to myself as I gave them a hug after the interview, I'm not sure if their son is still alive. He had lost part of an arm because of a grenade during the initial attack. Was he really still drawing breath on this earth? I didn't know. I was skeptical. I was, of course, hopeful and praying and just the anguish for them. I can't imagine. Well, there's an update, and it came today. Hamas released a video of this young man, of Hirsch, a hostage video, extremely disturbing. You can see his arm is half gone but is healed up. And he, at least according to some of the clues and the number of days he's been held that he mentioned, is apparently still alive. This is an American, a young man with parents and friends and loved ones praying, begging for his release. He is still alive, it seems. Thank God. What a relief it must be for the parents just to know that for now. It's still got to be sort of renewed frustration and terror in that sense, but at least the worst fear for now, for the moment at least, has been allayed, postponed, or perhaps erased. I can only imagine that his parents, Rachel and John, feel reinvigorated in their push to bring their son home and all of these remaining hostages home, however many are still alive being held up by Hamas. They are not an afterthought. They are not a side note. They are not a footnote in all of this. It is a central piece of what's going on, and they represent what happened on October 7th. I am amazed and so happy for now that Hirsch is still alive. Bring him home. There should not be any conversation about this conflict, anything about it, that does not make the hostages and their plight central. That is an incredible development. I pray for this young man and his family. New hope today. It's the Guy Benson Show on this Wednesday from New York City. I'll see you on Gutfeld tonight, back here on the radio tomorrow. Same time, same place. Thank you for listening.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Janice Dean, Fox News senior meteorologist. Be sure to subscribe to the Janice Dean Podcast at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And don't forget to spread the sunshine.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.